It's hour one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome to another Future Tuesday. And of course, we have Mrs. Future in the studio. You're our co-host.
Sitting tight here in the driver's seat. Got the knobs under my thumbs.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this will be our last show for August, as we are going to Canada for 3 weeks.
I thought we were going
to
do
a show. We might try to do a show. That's true. We're going to try to do a show from Canada, but if not, you'll hear from us.
Yeah. I don't know. Dr. Future, you're always right.
You never know, right? I mean, when you do long-distance stuff,
that's,
you know, communications.
True. I mean, 2 weeks in this time of year is a very, very long time. I mean, a lot could happen in 2 weeks, right?
The dog days of August.
Yeah, really. Right? Okay, so.
Come back with a whole new show in September.
Right. All right. So. In the meantime, since we have quite a slate of interesting factoids to review before we have some company over
the
airwaves.
Just to keep you excited, we're actually bringing in Dr. Ralph Abraham in the second hour, a professor of mathematics at UC Santa Cruz.
A well-known local character.
Who will also be talking about his new book, which is about the history of his experiences in Santa Cruz back in the 60s. So it should be quite engaging. It's the very beginnings of UC Santa Cruz and what it was like back then and the kind of scene that was happening here.
Yes, and of course, what I always associate with Ralph Abraham is chaos theory. He's a real expert in chaos theory, so maybe he'll bring a little extra chaos with him.
Yeah, you want some chaos? You're ready for a little shaking things up a little bit?
Let's just say I'm prepared.
Yeah? You think our election needs a little chaos?
I think there's quite enough in the election process. I think there's no accident that the professor of chaos is coming on the show today of all days.
Yes.
In this election season, in this time of year.
There must be a deeper meaning to this.
We'll see. Stay tuned. Expect the unexpected.
Yes. Also in the studio today, we have a visitor from the outside, Frankie Lee Slater.
From the outside?
From the outside world. Remember when we were visiting Pixar? You know, you get a little sticker that has a little alien with three antennas and it says, look, a visitor from the outside. So Frankie Lee is a longtime friend, communicator, a networker, a person who has been exploring.
Come up close to the mic, Frankie Lee.
The larger community, traveling around, living a nomadic life for several years now.
And, nomadic by intention and design.
Exactly, yeah. So welcome, Frankie Lee.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with my longtime friends. And yeah, it'll actually be 64 months on Wednesday of this week that I've been out and about living with people.
When you let go of your house and decided to...
Home is everywhere. So I've lived in over 150 homes with wonderful folks that are all woven together in my understanding, like we really are, like us.
Extended family of some sort.
Yeah,
it's quite a spiritual journey. I mean, when I think of you, I associate you with another person who I have deep admiration and respect for, a woman named Peace Pilgrim. Did you ever hear of Peace Pilgrim?
Yeah, sometimes that comes into the conversation, the likeness, yeah.
Right. And, you know, just someone who really knew that the way to really practice your faith is to just be out there living it every day and to put one foot in front of the other and see what life brings you.
Yeah, it's also a feeling that, you know, there's just so much talk in today's world, and it's almost like what people think if they talk about something, they're in action, and there really is a difference. And so to step into it and be it and be a living model seemed like the most, you know, I could contribute that. Take it into action. Go live with people in the American home.
Yeah.
And see what it's actually like.
What's going on for people for real beyond their social presentation, you know, at the depth, and what can make a difference for them, which I feel, you know, I've learned a lot.
People's real needs and wants.
Yeah, which is pretty basic, you know, to feel connected and to know we're creative and to come together.
And by living with people, you've had a chance to connect them with others that maybe increase their experience of life in a positive way?
Yeah, connect them with others and also just like understand how to orient to the people they're connected with in a way that's more energy efficient for all of us. So we're not in the busy, overwhelmed, you know, someday win, you know, conversation, but we're actually able to rely on one another and get the goodness of our being here together.
Conversely, I imagine you'd see sometimes that some people perhaps should break off a connection that's not serving them.
Yeah, I think it's less that. It's more the expression of the relationship that is, like I stayed with a couple who they were staying together for all of those romanticized reasons that, you know, they weren't really fitting inside of. And so what I counseled them on was, you know, the best interest of each person involved. You know, if they really cared and loved each other, that's what they would want. And then having that focus allowed them to move on in a way that was really loving.
And what about fear? I mean, I imagine that you've had to encounter a lot of fear both in other people and in yourself. You know, what kind of lessons have you developed?
Yeah, well, definitely on both fronts. You know, in terms of others, I feel like there's a lot of unconscious triggers that people don't recognize, you know, until they get triggered and then they show up big time. And then to be able to be present with somebody while that energy could be coming right at me, you know, and I find it really goes to the distortion of the mind and a lot of the thoughts that we carry forth that we think is reality. And then we, you know, keep playing them out and fear and frustration, the things that we live with. And then in terms of myself, absolutely. I mean, it's hard not to buy into prevailing thoughts. So even though I have a good, strong, you know, deep connection with my own source and what I'm about and the purpose of what I'm doing with Circles Uniting, I also, you know, if someone's thinking I'm some bag woman who, you know, can't find the next place and they're heavily projecting it at me, you know,
Well, that's people's fear. You know, the homeless is a big fear in our society, yeah. Right? You know, no one wants to be out on the street.
Yeah. And I stayed with a gal, very savvy, British gal, advertising background. Yeah. And she was quite frank about it. She said, you know, it brings up a lot for me to be around you because that, you know, it makes me wonder about myself.
What
and could I end up in that?
If I lose my house and I have to travel between friends, what's going to happen to me?
Yeah. But ultimately, you know, when you find the currency of relationship, which is obviously what's allowed me to go the, you know, this long, you know, this deep.
64 months.
That really is the deeper sense of home is everywhere. You know, then it becomes, where is home? Well, home is Gaia. Home is Earth. Home is the garden. And that opens up. One of my favorite things about being this person for other people is to be with John Lilly, who also housed me at one point, called being a permissionary.
Permissionary.
Yeah. That's a great name. All right, folks, we're going to be back with some Dr. Future Show and headlines and our friend Frankie Lee to comment with us. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Okay, we're back to the Dr. Future Show. Peter Thiel's in the news this week, you know, the billionaire technology investor and Donald Trump supporter.
Yeah, didn't he get rich with PayPal and then he just kept investing in thing after thing? He's one of the big, he loves to hire 20-somethings into companies and turn them into instant billionaires, right?
That's well, apparently there's something else about 20-somethings that he likes too. Uh-huh. You know, it just came out in Inc. magazine this week. He's always been fascinated with life extension, longevity research, and he's spent millions on various anti-aging medicine startups, a lot of money researching this material. He believes that our society should open its mind more to these such technologies so that we can live longer and be healthier.
Sure.
All right.
Could I just interrupt you for a second?
Certainly. Because
when you say anti-aging, I'm thinking, if you want to live forever, shouldn't you be pro-aging?
Well, aging.
Shouldn't you make it good for you?
pro aging.
Anyway, just to decide.
I don't know, man.
I didn't mean to trip you up there,
Okay, life extension. How about that?
Okay.
But some of the techniques are a little wonky, right? They sort of hit that uncanny valley. On one of them is a practice known as parabiosis, which he's been investing.
Parabiosis. That sounds so scientific.
Well, that's the scientific element. It's a potential biological fountain of youth. It's the closest thing that our science has discovered to an anti-aging panacea.
Oh, boy. Everyone's going to want to sign up for it.
Yeah.
What exactly is it?
Well, it's real simple on one level. It's basically putting the blood of young people into older people.
Oh, you know who's really into that?
Who's that?
Baron von Harkonnen in Dune.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah, man. He harvested all kinds of things from young people just because he could.
I don't know.
Peter Thiel von Harkonnen, is that what you're telling me?
No. In the scientific circles, my dear, crude experiments, I say crude, began in the 50s when they were cutting rats open and stitching their circulatory systems together. But this whole field has been kind of languishing on the fringes for decades now. And it's recently starting to get more attention from mainstream researchers. There are multiple clinical trials underway with humans in the U.S. and even more advanced studies in, guess where? Korea, China.
Yeah, places where they can coerce people to give up their blood without compensation and where slaves have no choice and the powerful get to decide how to administer their organs.
You think?
Well, I do. It's so scary to me. This is like Cloud Atlas. This is like the worst nightmare I can imagine.
Look, let's just look at it from a scientific point of view for a moment, and then we'll bring in the psychobiological fears.
Well, look, okay, scientifically, other people's blood, if they're healthy and you're not, I could hear how it's good for you. And, you know, there's already a lot of work in getting people to donate blood.
Okay.
Well, and there's always a shortage of donated blood.
Yeah.
So now you're saying that it's going to be like a fountain of youth, and that is going to be...
It's a beginning of research in this area. In Monterey, in our listening area here, hi, Monterey people, there's a company called Ambrosia, and they've recently commenced a trial along these lines called the Young Donor Plasma Transfusion and Age-Related Biomarkers Trial.
You mean people can get a job, like donating their blood?
Yeah, it's healthy participants age 35 and older get a transfusion of blood plasma from donors under 25, and then the researchers monitor their blood over the next 2 years for molecular indicators of health and aging.
Well, I guess that beats working in a coffee shop.
This study is patient-funded. Participants, the elders, of course, pay $8,000 to take part.
So let's see, if these 20-somethings like donate blood like once a month for 5 years, then they can save up enough money to like be the recipients of donated blood once they turn 25?
Yeah, it's an investment program. Yeah, give blood now so later you don't have to.
It's like a blood bank.
So you can get some.
This is a real vampiric world here.
Well, look, you know, blood is, as I mentioned earlier, it's that uncanny valley. It's that area that seems a little weird, but...
It's thicker than water.
Yeah, but it's a real thing. Ambrosia's founder is a Stanford-trained physician named Jesse Karmazin, and he's been studying aging for over a decade. And
is he from Transylvania?
It doesn't say in the Inc. article, but I doubt it. He became interested in launching a company around parabiosis after seeing impressive data from animals and studies of humans abroad. One trial after another, subjects experienced a reversal of aging symptoms across every major organ system. Mm. While the mechanisms aren't really understood yet, young organisms' blood not only contained all sorts of proteins that improve cell function, but somehow it also prompted the recipient's body to increase its production of those very proteins. So it stimulated the older person's body to make more of those young person's protein.
I'm an experiential learner, so I would want to have to try it on for size before.
Would you be willing to try a young person's blood?
I might. I've looked at
you're 60
a lot
plus
of things
now, right?
to do
yeah.
with.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay,
I
so
am.
You're
been
ready.
Been on the road
this.
That long.
Yeah, I've been on the road 64 months.
Okay. It's a funny thought to, have someone else's life force energy come into your body. I feel like there's other ways we could go about that.
Well, I mean, a lot
might
of...
might be more profoundly mystical.
Well, a lot of older guys generally prefer younger women. Maybe that's related to this, too.
They've always been wanting to get a shot of...
Yeah. I wonder if blood has a gender. You know, I wonder if a guy needs to get guy's blood or, if it would affect your personality if you got a blood that was, from, the opposite gender. they say when people have organ transplants that they start experiencing things that are not from their own memory.
They have memory of the cellular memory. Cellular memory.
Remember,
we're talking about blood plasma here. Uh-huh. You know, so it's not the full blood. It's like filtered, and it only contains the plasma component of the blood.
Oh, I got it. So it's not really
it's got
just
proteins
like,
and stuff. But
it's
it
not
doesn't
the stuff
have,
that vampires drink.
It's, no, it doesn't
a,
have
a refined version of that.
Yes. Yeah, we're scientific.
We
Come
put
on.
It into a centrifuge and we just take out like the good
man.
Stuff.
Yeah, that's
just,
right.
Just
that's
the liquid.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, you keep your viruses. But give me your proteins.
Okay. This is the world we live in. You know, blood is something we all share. And one of the things that I love about blood is that blood cells all like to find harmonic resonance with each other. So probably I could see that being a net positive. You know, the youthful, idealistic, inexperienced blood cells mixing with the tired elders who have a lifetime of experience and then giving them a recharge and getting all on the same page.
Oh, good. I'm glad you came around, Mrs. Future.
Together.
I was a little worried about you there for a minute. However, you know, Peter Thiel is quick to point out that there's no single panacea to the aging process itself. It's possible that there exists single point things that could work, like parabiosis, where it affects a lot of systems of the body. But this is where the young blood in older mice did find a massive rejuvenating effect.
Hmm.
You know? Ah, Richard says, true blood from Japan.
True blood. Oh, yeah? From
that must
Japan?
Be...
Well, we'll have to check the link,
be,
huh?
HBO series, True Blood.
Oh, it is a vampire series.
Yeah. Did you ever have blood analysis? Have you, you know, like those high...
Check out what's in your blood?
Yeah, because I had that when I first did Raw Foods years ago, the program that I participated in, they did that. And you got to see, really, for me, it was so profound that everything actually lives inside of us. This idea that it jumps on us from the outside, it's actually the environment that allows for things to prosper, like yeast or what have you. So it's all there. So... it makes me think of that, you know, oh, okay, now you're going to bring. So the whole notion for me of that was, oh, it is me. It's, you know, it's inside. It's the whole universe is there. Now we're bringing these other entities in from other person.
Well, that's there's evidence that we have a collective immune system.
Uh-huh.
We already exchange a lot of microbiome, a lot of microbes with each other all the time already. So there's a tremendous amount of exchange going on in a population as it is.
Yeah, you know, this show has, over the years, really helped me to understand how much our bodies are like planets. They are ecosystems. They are microenvironments with lots of separate regions.
Lots of ecosystems inside our bodies.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, trying to be healthy with that kind of consciousness is very different than having a war model saying like, oh, we have to like kill one organ to save another.
Mm. Right. Well, in this case, the plasma is relatively abundant, has a 2-year shelf life, and it could be good. It could be good for the young donors. It could be good.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, once those hamburger jobs go away for the robots, then, you know, young people can get their economic start in life by donating some blood.
Oh, yes.
All right. Listen, got to go to our
so
CBS
true,
News
Future.
Break. I hope Donald Trump doesn't get in. We'll be right back. Dr. Future Show.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We have another blood story this week as well. I don't know how many of you have been tracking Theranos, the Theranos company. You heard of them at all?
I don't think so.
Theranos, it's over in the valley also in Palo Alto area. CEO Elizabeth Holmes had been a billionaire a couple of months ago, and now she has nothing. Remember, it's been a big controversy about her company's blood tests.
Uh-huh.
She had a Theranos product. She was claiming to do that it did more than what it actually did. And it caused some controversy. Well, she has risen from the ashes and has a new blood testing kit that could serve as the successor to their controversial previous machine that got her in so much trouble, the Edison machine. And she spoke at the annual meeting for the American Association for Clinical Chemistry and said that the new machine is called the Theranos Sample Processing Unit, or Mini Lab, the size of a computer printer, and it'll be able to run a battery of tests on just 160 microliters of blood taken from a pricked finger. And she showed clinical data that detailed 11 tests the mini lab can run on blood samples, including one for the Zika virus, which is all the rage in the news right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the company says it can run up to about 40 tests. The Verge checked this out, and some experts say that they don't see how this is actually possible, that you would need to have three or four samples, not one sample, to run all these tests that she's claiming from 160 microliters.
Hmm.
So she's lifting the veil of secrecy this time and not keeping a secret how it works, and is showing people how this actually works. The new machine is described as a prototype. The technology and techniques have long been used by doctors and scientists already, and that every piece of it has been known for years. It's just the combination of these pieces in a new configuration and more compact form than any of the competitors. The critics are saying, this looks like a bait and switch thing, but maybe not. But we know that the technologies for analyzing blood and that sort of thing are going to get better, and they're going to require less blood, and we're going to find out more and more from blood. It's the right direction. That's why she got so much capital in the first place. As to whether or not this new machine works, well, I think sooner or later it will. We're moving in that direction.
So everybody's going to have their own little home finger pricker. They'll do their own home blood analysis, and then that'll be fed into their AI, their personal AI that says, oh, I think you need some more vitamin C today.
Well, if you can run up to 40 tests on one prick of blood and it can keep you healthy, that's great. And, you know, of course, you start taking younger people's blood and mixing it in with yours.
Oh, that is totally going to confuse the AI.
Do you think?
Wait a minute. This is not the same blood we looked at yesterday. I don't know what to tell you.
No, you'll have a stable of young people that you help support because there's no more jobs and the robots are doing them all the time. And you have the young people work the robots for you and you take their blood.
This sounds scary. I'm a little bit more like, you know how it used to be?
It's a win-win.
Like in the Middle Ages, you had this idea of like little Tommy singing for his supper, right? So now you're going to have like, you know, these bands of young people coming around and like, you know, offering to let you prick their blood to give them an income, to let them flow.
Well, yeah, I think it's a capitalist society. I mean,
it's not going to be a capitalist society for long, man. Once we turn over all the jobs to the robots, it's going to be something new. It's going to be something that is created by people who actually preserve their humanity and use their humanity to come up with creative ways to bless each other.
Okay, well, that could happen once people don't have to worry about money anymore. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs and all that.
The whole thing about worrying about money, that's just a modern shorthand for worrying about how you're going to survive in the world. It wasn't always money, but what money buys is the things that it always was.
Food, which is shelter, health,
place to be,
once you get the basics.
Safety and security, the ability to be generous, making sure you can feed yourself, making sure you don't have to be subject to violence. These are the things that money buys you. And the reason we use money is because it's a very convenient shorthand. But those other needs, they will exist even if we don't give ourselves access to money. Even if we turn over all the things that we do for money to machines, we're still going to need access to a place to live, a way to preserve our humanity, a way to educate ourselves, a way to take care of each other. All those things that money gives us, we're still going to need.
So what's your point, Mrs. Future?
My point is we got to think about how humans can be the best humans they possibly can be as we invent ourselves out of our existing reality into something that's totally different.
Yeah, and the idea of like relying on money for things, it's kind of, it made sense when we started to be mobile and you could carry it around or whatever, but now it's like you can just be direct action for the person right next to you. You can also do that, you know, so sometimes we have these in-between steps that we don't really need to be going to. So that's where the transition town movement, all these different things are coming in. We can be more in direct, just relationship currency. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, direct exchange of resources.
Just show up.
Rather than having to use money as an intermediary.
Phone lines are lighting up, folks. I guess we hit a nerve.
Okay, then. Well, let's talk to some of our listeners.
All right. First in line, Billy Sunshine. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Hey, Billy.
Hi, guys. So much interesting stuff. Real quickly, the reason she got so much money is because she came off like the female Steve Jobs is one reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was...
She was thinking different.
Sure of herself.
Yeah, and she just had the right outfit. I mean, look, the way she dressed helped get her money. It was amazing, really. She has an outfit, a whole look. It's an interesting brand that she created.
Yeah, good reality distortion
capitalism, film. Yeah. Capitalism is just a development phase of society that we no longer need. We're just at that point where we can leave it because, you know, when you have free energy and you have robots, then people get to be artists and creators and do what they like, and you don't need capitalism to move forward. And
yeah, it's a need for the industrial. Yeah, it's an industrial revolution thing. Yeah, tool of the industrial revolution.
Yeah, exactly. So we're about to leave that phase. Now, I want to talk about future medicine for a minute. Mm-hmm. I just cured cancer in
cured cancer
2 hours.
Yourself?
Yeah, I just cured cancer. Well, in me.
Congrats.
And you know what they did to cure it?
What's that?
It's very high tech. They used a ball of ice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Isn't that amazing? So they do what's called an ablation, and they just go in there with some needles, and they form an ice ball. They put super cold water down there. They form a big ice ball, and they just literally hold it against the tumor.
Wow.
And burn it away.
Wow. That's it.
Is it like a CO2 ice ball or something? I mean, is it really cold ice ball, like CO2 rather than...
I didn't want to know the technical issues, frankly. I figured out this was the least invasive surgery you could possibly have. There's no chemo, no radiology. Now, when I see what they charge me for ice, I'm bringing my own water next time, I'll tell you that.
All right, thanks, Billy. Listen, we're going to go to another caller, okay?
Yep.
All right.
Thanks, man. Appreciate your call.
Yeah.
I get.
Okay, so the next caller is actually our guest, Greg, I think, who wanted to Sigraf.
Hey, Greg.
Hi, Greg.
Hey there.
Hey, so what do you think of this blood thing, you know, to putting young people's blood in their system? Do you think that is something you'd consider doing?
Well, you know, there's a lot of evidence that if you have blood, if you give blood, it exercises your body's ability to make blood and your bone marrow and other blood-making methods of the body become stronger and you become healthier by letting blood out. So back in the medieval times, they had bloodletting was actually a way that they boosted people's immune systems and allowed them to sort of get over various illnesses. In many cases, the process of bloodletting, they would infect them, you know, with something at the time that they were doing it.
We're smart enough today to avoid the pitfalls, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but if you think about it, I mean, if you still have all the same blood circulating in you and it never, you know, you just rely on the body to sort of very gradually replace it rather than causing the body to sort of go on a sprint, you know, and exercise itself in making a bunch of blood because it notices that it lost some. It makes for much stronger blood. So the donors themselves get the opportunity to exercise their blood-making capabilities and boost their own immune systems. And then the recipients, of course, benefit from, you know, all the fresh blood factors from the young people that are more diminished in the older people's ability to make blood. Hmm. So it makes a lot of sense. Someone recently brought the attention to the fact that they think Ray Kurzweil looks like he's getting younger.
Uh-huh.
And he's, you know, he's someone who I would expect would research the science of this quite thoroughly. And if he saw there was a benefit and there was, and it was completely, you know, on the up and up to be able to do it, that he would experiment with that.
Yeah, I would imagine and Peter Thiel are buddies.
Yeah, well, yeah, the people that are involved in longevity research, you know, all seem to know each other because the researchers that are looking for funding in that area will rely on a lot of the same sympathetic sources of abundance that are following their work. Aubrey de Grey and the SENS Foundation are good examples of that. Mm-hmm. And then Stanford has a number of organizations that you know, have sprung out of there as well that are doing a lot of great work. Center for Longevity Research. So it's an exciting area. Diabetes drug metformin has been implicated in longevity. There's nicotinamide out of Japan. So there's a number of substances they're identifying now that are sort of leading them down the path towards a longer and a healthier life that we can intervene and do
great.
That.
Great. Well, that's a nice direction.
All right, sweetie. Hold tight. We're going to go to another break soon. And then I guess you have some data for us that's...
Share us a story or two from Seagraph.
Yeah. Since I spoke to you last, we had a chance to try out some other things, and we'll go over some of those.
All right, okay. Great.
See you in a minute.
Greg Panos, and this is the Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're just talking to Gregory Panos about some of the future things that he saw at SIGGRAPH, some really interesting projects at the special interest group Graphics, the gathering of all the graphics and animation people that actually happened last week. We got an initial preview from Greg last week, but he's actually been to the show now with a more fuller report. Greg, welcome to the show.
Hey there.
Yeah.
So, once I spoke to you last week, we went on to see quite a few other exhibits and technology and demos. So I'm going to report about some of those.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, first of all, because most people haven't directly experienced it yet, was there any improvement in the cheap seats, if you will, like Google Cardboard, the VR stuff, for having a low-end phone, it's a high-end phone to get into the bottom end of virtual reality? Is that getting better?
Well, what's interesting is all this excitement in virtual reality is growing the next leapfrog in smartphone technology. So smartphones are really quite powerful now, and the components are very inexpensive in order for everyone to have them.
Yeah, it's true, but they're still way cheaper than actually owning a VR computer, with the new NVIDIA or AMD card. It costs you a few grand, right?
Yeah. So, the resolution of smartphone imaging is fixed at a certain level where it's considered sufficient. Mm-hmm. But VR requires more higher resolution. If you're going to place the phone into some sort of housing with lenses and it gets closer to your eyes, you need even more resolution.
Yeah.
Now, like Samsung has a 4K panel coming out that will be in their, flagship smartphone. And once you place this phone into a VR visor, you'll see much clearer, much higher resolution, much wider field of view for VR.
Hmm.
So all the other manufacturers of smartphones are being pulled along in the same direction, because anyone that has a smartphone wants to be able to put it in a cheap visor and use it for VR.
So Samsung is leading the pack there. But what about Apple? Has Apple ever done anything with this yet?
Apple has been filing patents, acquiring some companies, and hiring experts in the VR field, and they're keeping mum for the moment. They're watching the blunders and the mistakes of the others in the industry right now that are spending a lot of money and either achieving some measure of success or stagnating. And they're going to probably take a very measured and calculated position on when and if they will release a VR product. I don't think it's a matter of if. I think it's when.
Hmm.
And whether it's going to meet some kind of qualitative standard that Apple is known for will be one of the things that they're delaying in order to ensure.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about the other end? How about VR experiences in the theater world? Is that unfolding at all? Can go to a theater and experience or is it not that kind of thing?
Well, the idea of immersing yourself in VR is sort of a non-collaborative concept in the physical world. I mean, you can have five people all in VR sitting in the same room and
you just need to have a place with the bandwidth and the gear.
Yeah. So they can all be in a virtual space together and being represented as virtual persona forms or avatars and interact with each other socially, but they don't have to be physically in the same place.
That's a real
transformative moment for VR, is when you can socially interact with people in a virtual space that's collaborative, and you physically are unbridled as to where you need to be.
Yeah, right. What did you see along those realms in terms of a collaborative social VR experience?
Well, I saw a couple of inertial mocap suits, the motion capture suits that you wear, these various sensors instrumented about your body on the various appendages, and they track the position of your arms and your legs and your wrists and your elbows and your neck, and they feed all that motion information back into the VR experience, and a character can be performed by all of your motions.
Mm.
So you can represent it in the virtual space like a person that's standing in front of somebody and bending over or dancing or jumping or running with them or sitting down, all in real time. And these IMU-based motion capture suits use the same tiny little sensors that go in the phones to detect which way they're tilted or which way they're moving as far as acceleration is concerned. They don't cost very much, so you can use a lot of them. And the suits themselves are inexpensive. They're less than $1,000. They'll probably even come down even more. And they compete directly with the high-end motion capture suits, which use expensive infrared cameras and retroreflective markers and all these other technologies that were in the past what people were using.
Yeah, so it's really a lot of the capabilities of the high-end stuff is now coming in these low-end suits.
So also facial tracking demos were, there were a number of them there, and VR visors that are doing your facial tracking to determine what your expressions are. So while you're in VR, your character can, you know, properly mimic the expressions that you have in real time.
It's a little more emotional content to the
sensual
experience.
Yeah, if you're sitting in a theater watching a virtual comedian and you start laughing and rolling on the floor and all these other things, you'll see the characters rolling on the floor and you'll see them smiling and laughing and chuckling and that kind of thing is all a possibility.
Was there any, plays or shows where it was particularly compelling for you at SIGGRAPH this year?
Yeah, SIGGRAPH has one exhibition night where they show what's called real-time live. So they use high-end PCs with high-end graphics cards for gaming and the unique opportunity to do animation in real-time with these systems was presented with an animated warrior woman who was performed live. So she had on a head-mounted camera that was tracking all of her facial movements, and she had on a full motion capture suit, and she was performing a live real-time photorealistic woman who was inside of a game environment, and they did like a little play. So she recorded one section with her, and then she recorded a second section with her interacting with herself, and then it was played back in real-time. So you could watch it performed in real-time, and you could watch it collaboratively played back in real-time with a number of different layers. So that blew a lot of people away. It's been presented at a number of gaming conferences this year as well. It's the advancement of what we call performance animation technology being used in a gaming development context.
Nice.
It sounds to me like John Malkovich.
Yeah, and ILM had a great panel on The Force Awakens that was very well attended. I got to ask some questions about the virtual cinematography work that's being done at the ILM X Lab to help directors block and plan scenes for their movies in real time and integrate motion capture actors into the real time planning and storyboarding that they're doing for these projects.
Oh, that's very exciting. So Hollywood is really embracing the cinematic opportunity, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, Jim Cameron really took the bull by the horns with the Avatar movie. He used this technology initially to build a virtual camera that was basically a tablet with a motion tracking on the tablet holder, and you could move the tablet around in the space and see the point of view of the cinematography camera that was virtualized into the space. So it helped him plan a lot of the scenes and direct all the motion capture actors, so when they acquired that data, he knew that he got the performance that he needed, albeit it may have been rendered at a lower resolution in the process of him doing his planning, but the data was just as easily used to render very high-resolution characters that ended up on the screen and the film.
So do you see this process as something that's going to be affordable for lots of indie filmmakers?
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount of democratization that's happening on the hardware and software level. Google has created a whole division called Daydream that is looking at taking their sort of initial sort of cheap cardboard VR configuration and adding from the ground up extra ability to do motion tracking and to be content aware of the environment that it's in order to overlay and do augmented reality and to add higher resolution imagery into a space. So I think the future is actually quite bright for the low-end VR that will have the performance and the meet the expectations of people that are experiencing it that are used to the higher-end systems. So you're right, you can buy high-end systems right now that are expensive, but all of that performance will probably come down towards the lower-end smartphone-based visors that clip into little lens packages that sit on your head and track them in space.
Anything that impressed you in the education teaching world with what you saw at SIGGRAPH for VR?
Well, I saw a very unique volumetric imaging display from Lightspace Technologies. It's a 3D multiplanar display that has probably, a half a dozen or so or a dozen panels that are translucent or transparent, and they are arranged in a cube configuration. You look through the cube, and it sequences imagery onto each of the panels. If you look at a regular LCD panel for your computer, your regular monitor on your computer, you could strip away the backlight and other things, and it would be a transparent display that would exhibit the same material that you would put on it when you're like scrolling through a web page or the like, except it wouldn't have any, you'd see right through it.
So let me ask, so what you're seeing is a computer screen that's inside the virtual world? So you're kind of
No, it's a physical device that's a bunch of windows that are stacked in the depth dimension. And the computer that feeds imagery to this box feeds it one plane at a time very quickly, and it gives the impression of volumetric depth. So you're looking through a screen, and without glasses, you see a man's head that's rendered and is turning around and looking around, and you see the front of it, and you see the back of it, and you don't need shutter glasses, and you don't need the plastic glasses that you see in a 3D movie, and anybody can see it.
Okay, well, listen, thank you, Greg. We're out of time right now. Appreciate your update on SIGGRAPH 2016. You have a good week, and we look forward to future reports from you and Richard.
This is KSCO Santa Cruz, and the Dr. Future Show will be back after the break with Ralph Abraham.